Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today my guest is Bill Hartung, Director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New American Foundation, which is a non-profit, non-partisan public policy institute that invests in new thinkers and new ideas to address the next generation of challenges facing the United States. Bill is the author and editor of numerous books and studies, including most recently Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, published in 2008 by Paradigm Press. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other major news outlets, and he's been a featured expert on NBC News, CNN, the BBC, and Fox News. Bill Hartung, welcome to the program today.
Glad to be here.
Now, Bill, I've used you numerous times for information and data on what's happening with the arms race and military spending. You're one of the world's experts, I believe, in this area. Do you want to just do a sort of short summary, Bill, of what is happening now specifically in the United States with what they call defense spending? Of course, it's not defense, it's offense. And I think where things stand under the new presidency.
Yes. Well, you know, unfortunately, as a result of the Bush buildup, the United States is spending more than it's spent at any time since World War II, more than the height of Korean War, more than the height of Vietnam War, more than the Reagan buildup. And it's, you know, depending how you assemble it, it's generally, these recent years, been over $700 billion, counting the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Per year,
yes.
And does that include the black box items too?
Well, it's believed that they're folded in there, but of course we don't know for sure.
No.
And it doesn't include things like veterans benefits and the interest on the debt that comes from militarism and military aid. And, you know, that would push it up more, you know, reaching towards the $1 trillion mark.
What about the money spent in NASA, which is now a huge amount, all allied to the space race and the arms race? Is that included?
That would be over and above the $700 billion figure also. So there's the Homeland Security Department. It's kind of insinuated itself into many parts of the U.S. government beyond the Pentagon.
How much has been spent on Homeland Security since 9/11, and how much is spent currently per year on, quotes, Homeland Security?
Well, it's been running about $30 to $35 billion a year.
Really?
So, you know, probably well over $200 billion since September 11th.
Yeah. Okay, so we're probably up around, if you include many areas that are not always spoken about, nearly $1 trillion or over that, which is, I mean, $1 trillion rolls easily off the tongue these days, doesn't it, Bill?
Well, you know, it's when they throw $1 trillion at the banks so it can disappear down a black hole, it sort of makes these military numbers seem at least, certainly not normal, but in line with some other things that the government is doing at the moment. Of course, these bailouts hopefully will be more or less a one-time thing, whereas when you're spending $1 trillion a year in the military, unless we really stand up against that, that could go on year after year after year, as it did, you know, during the Bush administration.
And so how much did the Pentagon budget increase during the Bush administration from the Clinton administration?
Well, it almost doubled, and even with inflation, probably 75%. So it's it's really, I mean, Clinton was no arms controller.
No. You know,
early on, he sort of caved to the Pentagon and said, you know, we'll cut this far and no further.
Yeah.
In fact, Bush's father made deeper cuts in the military budget than Clinton did. But, you know, under Bush, it reached new levels of obscenity, I would say. You know, when we get to these numbers, it's really hard to imagine what that could possibly be needed for.
Yeah. What are the drivers behind this insanity, as you called it, Bill Hartung?
Well, I think there's sort of a couple of levels. One is to the extent that the executive branch, the Pentagon, the Congress to some degree, want the United States to be a global military power with global reach, with military bases all over the world, with the ability and interest to fight two wars at a time, as they're doing now in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's a substantial driver. But even with all that, there's tens and hundreds of billions of dollars that aren't being devoted to those efforts. And a lot of that is driven by the military-industrial complex. So the companies want to build things like the F-22 fighter plane, which is the most expensive combat aircraft ever built. It's about $350 million each. And even Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said, you know, we're not using this thing. There's two wars going on. They're not using it in Afghanistan. They're not using it in Iraq. Obama said in the State of the Union, you know, we need to get rid of weapons we're not using, which was sort of seemed to be a signal that maybe the F-22 was going to be eliminated, at which point Lockheed Martin, the manufacturer, went into overdrive, putting ads in Washington Post and pressing members of Congress about the jobs in their districts. They got 44 senators and 200 members of the House of Representatives to write to Obama. That's a slip of the tongue. Some people think of Obama as Clinton too.
Oh, God, do they?
Well, let's hope it doesn't come to that.
Oh.
But anyway, so even what would be a relatively modest change, it would be about $4 billion a year out of this close to $1 trillion that's spent in all forms of military spending. You've got a fight on your hands. You really have to go up against this formidable military industry lobby, which basically gives misleading figures about the numbers of jobs involved and does not talk about the fact that there's much more constructive ways to employ people.
It just seems like a behemoth that is unstoppable, and most people, I think, are semi-unaware of the amount of their tax dollars that are spent on this insanity. And meanwhile, you know, people are suffering most dreadfully with lack of health care and poor education, and bridges are falling apart. Do you think, after Obama's wonderful rhetoric during the campaign and actually since, that he has the courage, Bill, to take on this behemoth and challenge it frontally?
Well, there's been a few promising signs. He has talked about the need to eliminate nuclear weapons. He took funding for one of the Pentagon's favorites, the reliable replacement warhead, which would have been built and put on all existing U.S. Nuclear delivery vehicles.
That's actually a hydrogen bomb, just to let people know.
Yes, it sounds very innocuous.
Yeah.
When you talk about it in that sort of antiseptic language that the Pentagon comes up with. So anyway, he eliminated the money for that in his recent budget. And he has given Hillary Clinton authorization to start talking about deeper cuts with Russia. He said he will push to get the U.S. to finally ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. So he's put himself on record as, you know, wanting to do the right thing.
Yeah.
It's going to be, you know, a fight on that front too. But I think it's encouraging. He's really the first president in memory who's made that kind of public commitment.
Yeah, it seems to me, Bill, that what he needs to do, he's sort of reaching out to the American people via Jay Leno and 60 Minutes, but I think that the model of Roosevelt's fireside chats, where he really confided with the American people, he's got the ability to do that, and he has permission as Commander-in-Chief to sit down and say, now I want to tell you about Lockheed Martin, which is the biggest Pentagon purchaser or maker of weapons, and just reveal all. I mean, do you think that could be a possibility, Bill?
Well, I mean, he's certainly got the skills for it. He's smart, he's articulate. I think he does better in that kind of format than soaring rhetoric, which I think is great, and there's a place for it, but it's sometimes hard to use as a way to get that kind of nuts and bolts education done. I think he would need to really be pushed in that direction. He said a number of things that indicate that he knows how the game is played.
Yeah.
And I think it's just partly a question of which fights he's willing to pick, and I think part of that would be related to what kind of public pressure we can generate. I think a lot of people are so relieved that George W. Bush is no longer president,
yeah.
Dick Cheney's no longer vice president, that there may have been a bit of a letdown. This notion of, well, you know, we've gotten to this point, and let's give Obama a honeymoon, and he'll take care of it. And I think now with the seeing how difficult the economic situation is, I hope people realize that if we want them to focus on some of these other areas, there's really going to have to be significant public outcry, public pressure, and that we can't assume that Obama's just going to do everything he promised just because he said the right words.
Well, he calls for his grassroots supporters, of whom there are millions, to help him. And I guess this is the opportunity. I mean, when you look at the outrage about the bonuses given to the AIG employees and other bonuses, which were simply outstandingly dreadful, that's nothing compared to what Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Boeing have been up to with people's tax dollars. I mean, it would be interesting if we could work out some way, Bill Hartung, to transfer the rage, which is totally appropriate, to where it, not that the bonuses don't denote rage or demand rage, but into the areas where there's massive spending and stealing from the American people. But how on earth you educate people about what is actually going on behind the curtain, behind the scenes? Have you got a notion of how that could be done, Bill?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, it's hard to get people to understand $1 trillion.
Why don't you explain what $1 trillion really is?
Well, it's well more than every other country in the world spends on its military. It's more than half of the discretionary budget of the United States. So it's more than the U.S. government spends on everything else but Social Security. So it's administration of justice, it's environmental protection, it's building housing, it's feeding people below the poverty level, it's educating our kids, it's everything you can think of, all the positive things that government does combined get less money than we get from the Pentagon. And even relatively small matters, things that would be important for us to do, like spending money to lock up loose nuclear weapons around the world, you could do a proper job of that for about $3 billion a year. And that's the cost of a few days of the war in Iraq. Likewise, you could, for a day of the war, you could double the budget of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is really the main institution that's trying to figure out where the bombs are and to try to keep countries, new countries, from developing them. So and there's many other examples, which I don't have on the top of my head, but there's good groups like the National Priorities Project based in Massachusetts, which breaks it down by program, by congressional district, how much your city's paying in taxes to support this. I did a thing a few years ago called the Lockheed Martin tax. Just how much does it take just to pay Lockheed Martin off? And it comes to about $200 to $250 million a year per household. $200 to $250 per household. But of course, the people at the top don't pay any taxes. The people at the lower levels can't afford to pay taxes. So it really hits, you know, a much smaller number of households that are really paying the freight. So for them, it's probably, you know, $500 a year just to support that one company. And if you add Northrop Grumman, you add the whole, you know, military-industrial complex, then you're probably talking thousands of dollars per year. You know, and if you ask somebody...
Per household.
Right. Would you rather write a $2,000 check to Northrop Grumman or spend it on something else? I think the answer would be pretty clear.
See, people don't know that, do they, Bill? They just don't know that. They're unaware that their tax dollars just go into this huge bag.
No, I don't think anybody, well, you know, very few people grasp how enormous it is. And somehow, you know, the only thing that's communicated clearly, and the other side does this very effectively, is fear. You know, we need to be afraid. It's a dangerous world. Therefore, just to be safe, let's throw more money at the military.
Yeah, but people are pretty frightened now about their very survival. I mean, it occurs to me if we could buy full-page ads in the New York Times, Washington Post, and et cetera, LA Times, to say, do you know that, you know, thousands of your dollars per year go to support Lockheed Martin and others? You know, it seems like this is the time to get people really stirred up.
Well, and there's other threats to our existence. There's the economic crisis. There's climate change. That, you know, things that we can do something about.
Yeah.
And we can do something about, which would be a much better use of our money.
Oh.
And in fact, a colleague of mine, Miriam Pemberton, did an analysis of how much the U.S. government spends directly to try to deal with global warming versus what it's spent on the military.
Yeah.
It's 88-to-1 ratio. So $88 for the military for every dollar that they spend trying to address climate change. So it's, you know, it's really an unbelievable outrage. And it's, you know, basically throwing money at things we don't need that are going to cause harm and neglecting things that could help us deal with one of the biggest crises of, you know, the history of the species.
Well, it's throwing money at things that could possibly annihilate life on the planet within an hour, actually, because all of these military systems could precipitate at this point a global nuclear war versus saving the planet from global warming. You know, I used to use or have used an analogy, $1 trillion, I think this is right, is equal to if you spend $1 million a minute since Jesus was born, you would just be about at $1 trillion now. I mean, that...
Well, my watch doesn't work like that, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, Bill, can't you do it in your head?
No, well, not at my age. I
You're not an enfant savant.
My daughter could probably do it.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. Younger, more supple brain. Now, I'm interviewing Bill Hartung. He's the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New American Foundation, and a wealth of knowledge about the military-industrial complex and money spent unnecessarily, needlessly on weapons to kill people. Let's talk about Gates. I think he's quite a fascinating character. He sort of towed the line under Bush and Cheney, but he seems to be stepping out of line a bit now, and I think we're seeing more of who the man really is. What's your assessment of Gates as Secretary of Defense?
Well, I think, you know, the most hopeful interpretation is kind of a Nixon to China analogy, that he, you know, I think he's more of a realist, more in the Brent Scowcroft school than the, you know, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld school. And so I think he may have been somewhat taken aback by the direction of the Bush policy. And so, you know, he's not a peacenik, but he certainly thinks that there's a lot of unnecessary spending by the Pentagon that could be used for something else. And he's also has talked about that the State Department and diplomatic efforts are woefully underfunded. In fact, he gave some sort of stark examples. For example, it takes more people to run a U.S. aircraft carrier task force than there are trained diplomats in the entire U.S. Foreign Service.
Oh, God.
And the fact that he pointed that out indicates that he, you know, he's aware of that imbalance. I think where he's not going to be helpful is on the nuclear issue.
Really?
He's embraced this notion of the reliable replacement.
Has he?
And he gave speeches about it and even had an article in Foreign Affairs that dealt in part with that. I think, you know, the good news about that is I don't think Obama is going to buy into that.
Well, they've got enough nuclear warheads, America alone, to overkill everyone on Earth several times. You know, overkill means you kill them and they stand up again, you kill them and they stand up. It's a Pentagon term, but yeah, it's just the thinking is, well, I would call it psychotic.
I think that's right. I mean, they create this kind of twisted logic, and that, you know, the more you enter into it and act as if it's rational, the harder it is to extract yourself. I mean, they have this notion that they've been arguing that, well, they need a new warhead because, you know, we can't count on the current warheads to explode properly.
And kill 2 million people.
You know, God forbid you tried to end life as we know it and one of the weapons didn't go off. It really, you know, it's such an absurd concept, but yet they go before Congress, they talk about these things. They also are arguing that, well, they'll be safer, you know, because they'll be designed differently than existing warheads,
yeah,
and they won't use as many toxic materials. The workers will be safer, and it'll be harder for a terrorist to use them. They make it sound like it's some sort of health program or something. Gates has bought into that argument, unfortunately, but in a lot of other areas, he may actually be helpful to Obama in kind of blunting some of the conservative criticism and making it seem more quote-unquote normal to cut the military budget.
Yes, I was interesting in Obama's initiative just recently to say that they would send huge numbers of diplomats to Afghanistan as well as soldiers. I was fascinated by that concept, which is obviously needed, right, Bill?
Yes. When you mention Afghanistan, I just can't believe that Obama wants to go down that road of pouring more troops in there.
Mm.
You know, they've been strafing the Afghan-Pakistan border using unmanned aerial vehicles.
Well, first of all, before you go any further, I want you to describe to the audience what an unmanned aerial vehicle is, UAV. What are they?
Well, essentially, it's a combination surveillance plane and bomber, which has no pilot.
No pilot.
So if you look at one of these things, at least the ones that I'm familiar with, they have these huge wingspans.
Yeah.
Much, much longer than any normal sort of fighter aircraft.
Like a glider.
Like a gigantic glider. And
yeah,
then it's where the pilot would be, there's this sort of pod. So it almost looks like, you know, some sort of praying mantis that's been irradiated or something and grown to, you know, unbelievable size. And it further depersonalizes the concept of war. Not only is the pilot not at 15,000 feet, not having to sort of see the damage that they inflict, but they're not even in the same country.
Well, how do they launch their weapons? Describe the process.
Well, there'll be a control sort of trailer, a little building, and it could be, you know, for example, in Florida, and, you know, setting off bombs and shooting off ammunition that would, you'd be killing people in Afghanistan or Pakistan. And it's kind of a complex control board. In fact, you know, apparently the dial and the controls for setting off the bombs are right next to the one for self-destructing the weapon. So
self-destructing what?
Well, if they are afraid that the weapon's going to be, you know, somehow captured and reverse engineered and somebody can understand the technology, they'll just blow it up. And so sometimes they, by mistake, they blow up the weapon instead of having it drop at the bombs, which, depending what the target is or in general, may not be such a bad thing compared to the alternative. But so it's quite expensive to do all this. They sort of sold these things on the idea that, well, there's no pilot, you know, it's not using as much materials, it's going to be cheaper, but they neglected to mention that it's quite expensive to have these ground stations, and that the person at those controls on the ground is sort of the equivalent of the pilot, except, of course, they're not going to get shot down.
Okay, so to summarize, there's someone sitting at a control board in Florida, and because of the satellites and GPS system, they can see the targets, they're told about the targets, then they can direct the bombs from the drones or the unmanned aerial vehicles onto, say, a house in Afghanistan. And then what I found interesting the other day, I read an article which said that the people who launched the bombs at the control boards in Florida then can see the actual destruction and body parts that they've created, and that does them some sort of psychological trauma.
Yes, I think that's right. And, you know, I think there's going to be fewer people who want to do that sort of thing. They'll be sort of voting with their minds in a way, saying, you know, that's not something I want to be involved in. And they've actually had a shortage of people to do this, because initially they were only using people who had been pilots before.
Yeah.
Now they're running thin on that, so they're going to start using people who've never flown a plane and aren't used to that sort of quick reaction that a fighter pilot would have to be involved in.
So, Bill Hartung, in light of the present global financial crisis, but particularly hitting the United States of America, and there seems to be no end in sight, do you think that the American people, A, the Congress, B, and the administration, C, namely Obama, will wake up from this nightmarish dream that has been that has cloaked America really since 1945 to realize that the money that is spent on killing people, and now, as we said, is nearly $1 trillion a year, is money being stolen and could be used to help recover from the global financial crisis?
I think we have the opportunity to make that case, and also to just, you know, I think probably the best opportunity since the end of the Cold War to get people to understand that building more weapons not only doesn't protect us, but it causes great harm around the world, and then therefore great harm to the reputation of the United States, which spills over to people's opinion of American people in many regards. So I think because of the financial crisis, there's sort of a sense of need that, you know, if all this money is being thrown at the banks, what's left for the rest of us? And there's not going to be much left if we allow the Pentagon to continue to consume more than half of the discretionary budget. So I do think there's an opportunity. There's been some organizations, you know, budget coalitions that work primarily on domestic needs, who during the Bush years just threw up their hands and said, well, we're not going to change that, and let's just try to get money elsewhere, which was sort of a self-defeating strategy. But now those groups are coming around and saying that they will join with arms control groups and disarmament communities to push for changes in the military budget so that we can put some of those resources to more constructive use. So I see some changes. I'd like to see them go a lot faster, but I think there's a, you know, great opportunity here that we need to see.
Do you have any contact, Bill, with people in the Congress and the Senate? Because I know how they're kept in line by Lockheed Martin et al. They say, you know, you build an F-22 and parts of the plane are built in every single congressional district, so every single congressperson is captive to building that plane because it means jobs in their district. Are you able, with others of your ilk, to get to the congresspeople and senators to point out how ridiculous this spending is and how it could best be spent other than building weapons of mass destruction?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I did a little analysis of the Lockheed Martin claims about the F-22. They've been using this number over and over again, saying that it will create 95,000 jobs all over America. And so I looked at the amount that is spent on the F-22 and standard analyses of how much money $1 billion of military spending will create, how many jobs it is. And it looked like Lockheed Martin is probably overstating it by 2 to 3 times. That is, it might be 30 or 35,000 jobs per billion, not 95,000 jobs, as they claim. And I also am pretty sure that a lot of these claims about states and districts are much exaggerated. Some of these states, there might become some guy with a pencil and a pad, and that's the entire Lockheed Martin employment in that state. But they have the advantage of controlling the information. There was a reporter from USA Today who said, all right, if it's in these many states and these many districts and it's going to create these many jobs, can you share that information with us, the details? And the Lockheed Martin spokesperson said, oh, no, that's confidential business information.
Yeah.
So there's a clear manipulation underway, and we've been trying to educate some of the members that a lot of this is smoke and mirrors, and there's much more direct ways to help their districts than to kind of buy into this. And, of course, if you support the F-22 based on jobs in your district and you're trying to recruit a coalition, then somebody else says, well, I'll support you on the F-22 if you support me on the F-18, and I'll support you on missile defense if you support me on nuclear weapons. And so next thing you know, they've kind of woven together this kind of, coalition of death, sort of, which means that it costs us a huge amount. So it's not just the cost of the one plane, it's the cost of that way of doing business. It's sort of allowing the Pentagon and the contractors to distort the budget and the economy.
The cost of mass death. Huh.
So I do think, there's members who have been speaking out. So far, a lot of them don't have a lot of military stuff in their states or districts, so they're not kind of brought into that. But I think eventually we can get some other people to change. So Dianne Feinstein of California used to be quite influenced by the military industry. Now she's come out on, very well on some key issues. She's come out against the new nuclear warhead. She's come out for the ban on cluster bombs. She's spoken about the need to cut military spending. She's also, in a sort of related issue, been a strong advocate of gun control, which is a tough issue in the States. So, I think members can grow beyond that sort of pork barrel politics and that sort of narrow vision. In her case, it was partly her experience of gun violence, including becoming mayor of San Francisco after the assassination of the mayor and of
Harvey Milk.
So I think people's personal experiences and their moral compass can be appealed to and can, in some cases and hopefully more and more cases, trump this kind of military-industrial juggernaut that's really based on sort of crass considerations of dollars and cents and in many cases exaggerated suggestions of what the impact is of this kind of spending.
The one who really interests me, Bill Hartung, is Christopher Dodd, the senior senator from Connecticut. Now, Connecticut's budget and economy is pretty well based on the military-industrial complex, is it not?
Yes. They're the biggest per capita recipient of Pentagon money in the U.S.
Yeah, where the Trident submarines are made and ships and all sorts of things.
Aircraft engines and helicopters, and they have a Colt firearms manufacturer. So they're pretty well awash in a sea of military money.
Yet Dodd comes out, he appears to be sort of squeaky clean, but he must receive a lot of money from these corporations, and he seems not to be, he seems to be above criticism. Is that an accurate reading of him?
Well, I think, he's definitely a mixed bag. He has opposed certain kinds of military assistance to Latin America. But on the other hand, when there was a decision about selling helicopters, he it was a choice between a helicopter built in Texas and a helicopter built in Connecticut. And so he went on the floor of the Senate and said, you know, all the reasons why this Connecticut helicopter was superior. And he said, you know, I'm not just saying that because it's built in my state.
Yeah.
But, of course, that was why he was saying it. But this is kind of part of the charade, is that the members will say, you know, well, coincidentally, the best option happens to be the one that benefits my state and therefore will benefit my campaign coffers. So, you know, on a few issues he's been good, but then in other ways he's played the game as expected or hasn't been, you know, as it's been played for many years. And he doesn't get a lot of attention when he does that. You know, I think he's more associated with his work related to the economic issues and banking regulation and so forth. So his work on behalf of the military companies is kind of under this shroud. It's not really, not a lot of transparency, not a lot of public knowledge about that.
No, it's subliminal, under the table. Okay, well then, let's move on to the lovely man, Congressman Barney Frank from Massachusetts, who is heading, what is the committee he now heads, Bill?
He's in charge of the Financial Services Committee. So he's right in the middle of the effort to figure out how to get back some of this money that's been thrown at the corporations and to hold them more accountable during this whole bailout process. And, you know, he's been one of the more outspoken and more articulate members during that whole fight. And, you know, thankfully, he's made the connection with the military budget. And he has said, you know, we should be able to, we're spending at these record levels, we should be able to cut 25% easily. And that's,
From what?
From military spending. And he also thinks we should get out of Iraq much sooner. He thinks there's many weapon systems that should be thrown into the dustbin of history. I think he's set a good tone for the beginning of the debate that needs to happen. It's, you know, we could cut much more than that, but in terms of what's been spoken about in the Congress in the last decade, it's quite a, you know, courageous stand. Now he's trying to build a coalition working with activist groups and within the Congress to make something real out of that pledge. He mentioned this in the run-up to the election, and the Republicans tried to throw it back at the Democrats to show that they were soft on defense and soft on terrorism. They don't want to defend the country. And interestingly, those assertions didn't really have a big impact. So I'm hoping that means that people are not as easily, you know, driven into fear mode by those kinds of outrageous claims that, you know, in the past and certainly in the immediate wake of 9/11 were quite effective in manipulating people's sense of these issues.
Yes, I think he's in the driver's seat at the moment because of the financial crisis. Is he getting much sort of subliminal support? Do you think people are with Barney now on the 25% cut in the military budget?
I think to the extent that they're aware of it, I think there's a lot of support. You know, I think there still has to be some education done about the fact that that proposal is out there, that a prominent member has made that part of the debate. But I think, you know, we'd almost benefit from more hit back from the other side to elevate the visibility of the issue, because I think if we had a real public debate, there's no question we would win that debate. So he's getting the beginnings of support, and I think even some of the members who haven't spoken out realize that he's doing the right thing. And so, you know, if we can create political cover by having a big enough movement built around this, then I think some of them would come around.
So the movement needs to really expand enormously fast. I think the grassroots movement, Bill Hartung. Are people sort of starting to wake up and take the sleep out of their eyes and say, my God, you know, this military spending is absolutely insane, in especially now where we can't afford to pay our rent for our houses or our mortgages or get healthcare for the kids. Do you think people are starting to wake up now in general?
I do. I mean, I think there's been a little bit of people are a little bit back on their heels because of the enormity of the economic crisis. But, you know, as they find their footing, I think the military budget is an obvious place to look for money that's not only being wasted. I mean, if it was just being wasted, you know, I think we'd be fortunate. But it's also being used to cause great destruction. And as you said, it threatens life as we know it. So there's so many benefits of going after that money. You know, there's financial benefits, there's moral benefits, there's benefits in terms of being able to address real problems like climate change. And, you know, it's interesting, one thing that's almost taboo is the subject of poverty in the United States.
Really?
Well, I mean, in the sense that you don't hear, I mean, a lot of what's been talked about in the debate is about the middle class sort of falling out of the middle class, but the people who were poor in the first place have not gotten a lot of attention or support. And you can imagine if middle-class families are feeling it, the people who are poor in the first place are feeling it by many multiples of that. And, you know, I just don't see a lot of politicians standing up and saying, you know, we have to do something about this problem because a lot of poor people don't vote, and a lot of middle-class people have this skewed idea that somehow if we spend money on that, it's, you know, many people think that, for example, that the welfare budget is one of the largest items in the federal budget.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
fact, Lockheed Martin itself gets more money every year of our tax dollars than the largest federal welfare program by a good margin. So corporate welfare is much larger than anything to help and benefit individuals.
Yeah, it's socialism for the corporations, isn't it, Bill?
Well, yes, and capitalism for the rest of us.
What percentage of the American people would you classify as poor now, Bill?
Well, it's the measure they use would put it at about one out of every eight. But then if you look on the effect on children, it could be as much as one out of every four children in America. So it's a huge,
25%.
Huge problem.
Dear.
But a lot of people have this mythology that, well, this is the wealthiest country in the world, and people envy our way of life and so forth, without realizing that the problem of poverty is very close to home. You know, it's not just in Africa, but it's in the central cities of the United States also.
Yeah. If you drive through the back blocks of Vermont, you know, people are living in tar paper shacks, you know, in the middle of winter. So it really is pretty ubiquitous. I know that President Obama, though, is very conscious of this because of his own childhood and his own experiences. Would you agree with that, Bill Hartung?
I think he has a visceral understanding of it. I think there's sort of a political calculus of, you know, if he spoke, you know, honestly, clearly, and offered a vigorous program, that he would risk his majority, because there was a lot of reaching out to conservatives, Republicans, the upper middle class, and so forth. And so I think part of their logic is, well, if we don't have a majority, we can't do anything good. And so certain issues will have to sort of be dealt with in ways that are not, you know, really up to what is needed to solve them in order to maintain this majority and do some good in some areas. And I think, you know, given the support he has, I mean, he has something like 13 million people in his email network who are mobilized to do various things. He's, I think, you know, a very good communicator. I think if he had a more ambitious agenda and then did the job of public education in the way that you mentioned before, he wouldn't need to be so timid on some of these issues. I think he could put the Republicans and the conservative Democrats on the defensive.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think he needs to come on full blast, full frontal, and take them on, not this bipartisan stuff that he found failed during his last initiative when he was trying to get his stimulus package through and the Republicans all rose up as one, because he has so much more power than they do in all areas. And he has the voice, he has the charisma, and he's a commander-in-chief.
I mean, I think they would have to understand that if they don't come around, they're not going to be in the Congress next time around. And that means mobilizing people.
Yeah.
States where these people get elected. And I think he's capable of doing that, especially with the network that was built up during the campaign and the help of other, you know, interested networks. So it's really a strategic decision for him whether he's going to go in that direction. But I think otherwise, it's sort of the death by a thousand cuts. You know, you compromise on this, and you compromise on that, and you compromise on the next thing. And next thing you know, the junior Republican senator from Maine is deciding the policy for the entire country.
I mean, exactly.
It's crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get on to NASA, because NASA always has such a tremendous public profile and its propaganda is extraordinary. But I've just read a paper produced by Bruce Gagnon, who is one of the leading people opposing the arms race in space. And it was decided under George W. Bush in the late 2001 that all NASA missions in the future would be dual use. And that meant that every NASA space launch would be both military and civilian at the same time. And the military would ride the NASA Trojan horse and accelerate space weapons development without the public's knowledge. NASA would expand space nuclear power systems to help create new designs for weapons propulsion, permanent nuclear power bases on the Moon and Mars, etc. And that the NASA International Space Station was originally scheduled to cost $10 billion. It's now over $100 billion and it's not yet finished, but now it's all really related to the military. Would you like to address that, Bill Hartung?
Well, I think he's on to it. I mean, the notion of weapons base, I think it's quite frightening to people, and when they're made aware that this is even a possibility, I think you get quite strong opposition. And so the concept of hiding some of these programs within the NASA budget, which has a much more positive vision in people's minds going back to Kennedy and the moon launch, and, you know, the heroic stature of astronauts like John Glenn and so forth. And because a lot of the technologies do have overlap, I mean, just the launch technologies, the power technologies, the abilities to put things in the proper orbit so they could be used as weapons, I think it sort of cries out for an expose. And I think, you know, what Bruce has said needs to be plastered all over the front pages of every newspaper in the country, as long as there still are newspapers.
I know, isn't it tragic?
Or at least all over the web.
Yeah, do you think the New York Times is going to survive, Bill?
Yeah, I think there'll be, you know, a couple sort of boutique papers, probably New York Times, Washington Post, maybe a few others that have a large enough staff to do some foreign coverage, some investigations. And then for a lot of them, I mean, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer is going to go from a daily paper to a web-based paper, and they're going to go down to maybe as few as 20 staff people. So when you have that number of people, you can't really do major coverage. You certainly don't have the luxury of doing investigative reporting. And so then the question will become, you know, what can we make of the web? I mean, there's a lot of good information on the web, but it's kind of in these little niches, you know, where people look for kind of things they already know about. And so, you know, how do you get that sort of public comments where information on all sorts of things is provided to people on a daily basis? And I think that's really the challenge, because there's a lot of good blogs, a lot of good websites, a lot of good specialized sources of information, but it's more difficult on the web to sort of get a sense of a full range of issues and how those issues interact.
Get the full perspective. I'm interviewing Bill Hartung, who's the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. Bill, what are you working on specifically at the moment then? What is occupying your time and emotional energy in this area?
You know, all kinds of cheery things, you know, of course. We're doing a
you
report.
You being a very cheery fellow.
I have a lot of resilience and a lot of ability to confront these things and still feel optimistic about people being able to change, you know, what's going on. We're doing a piece on the cost of the plans to expand the nuclear weapons complex. You know, first of all, the point that if we're getting rid of nuclear weapons, you don't need this kind of complex, that it sticks out like a sore thumb, and it actually stands in the way of getting other countries to reduce their weapons or forego developing them.
And describe the complex that they want to expand.
Well, there's 8 major sites around the United States.
What are they?
There's weapons labs in New Mexico, Los Alamos, and Sandia. Sandia, coincidentally, is managed by Lockheed Martin.
Yeah.
Then there's Lawrence Livermore in California. There's a plant in Kansas City that makes the non-nuclear components of a nuclear weapon. In Oak Ridge, Tennessee, they enrich the uranium that's used in the bomb. In the Savannah River, South Carolina, they make generate tritium, which is sort of boost the efficiency of the nuclear explosion. In Pantex in Amarillo, Texas, they do the assembly and disassembly of nuclear weapons. So ideally, we would keep them busy taking the weapons apart rather than putting them together.
Yeah.
And then there's the Nevada test site, which at the moment is not doing underground testing, but which has been put in a state of readiness to resume that if requested to do so.
So what are their plans?
Well, they want to build some new factories. They want to build a new factory at Los Alamos that would make the plutonium triggers for the bomb. They want to build a whole new factory in Kansas City that will make all those non-nuclear parts of the bomb. They want a new uranium enrichment facility in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And then there's a number of smaller projects. The ones I mentioned are hundreds of millions, billions of dollars of investment. Then there's a number of smaller things they want to do all over this complex. And they've been selling it as an efficiency measure. You know, these plants will be more energy efficient, and there'll be dangerous materials within a smaller perimeter. It'll be easier to guard and so forth. So it's, you know, again, that they're not really addressing the question of, if we're going to disarm, why do you need this in the first place? Not only shouldn't you be modernizing, you should be dismantling it.
So the point to modernize is to build more weapons, right?
Well, right. They want to be in a position to build thousands of weapons, if requested, forevermore. And it should be rather that if we're going to have disarmament, then you should, part of the good faith gesture or diplomacy of disarmament should be we're going to get rid of our capability to build these things. Otherwise, you know, the arms race is just a stroke of the pen away from being restarted.
And how many hydrogen bombs does America currently hold? Those in storage, those on readiness alert, etc. What's the number?
It's believed to be, you know, if you count everything, would probably be in the range of 12 to 13,000.
Yeah.
And then the a similar number that the Russians have, and then other countries, much smaller but equally dangerous amounts. But about 95% of the nuclear weapons worldwide are controlled by the United States and the Russians.
And how many weapons would it take to produce nuclear winter and the end of most life on Earth, Bill Hartung?
Well, I haven't looked at that in a while, but I don't believe it would take more than in the hundreds.
That's right, about 250.
And so, you know, the whole notion that these things protect anyone in any way is just part of that psychosis that you talked about. I mean, the only way to be safe and the only way to protect ourselves against nuclear weapons is not building Star Wars. It's not, you know, threatening Iran. It's getting rid of all of them. Because there's sort of this idea that there's countries that are responsible enough to have nuclear weapons, and then the rest of the countries are irresponsible. And in fact, nobody is responsible enough to have these things, given what they are able to do.
Yeah. It's interesting then, in that context, the moves that Obama is making towards Iran at the moment.
Yes. I think it's, you know, it's hopeful that he is trying to reach out rather than do the kind of saber-rattling that we had under Bush. I think that was one of the most positive aspects of his campaign, was, you know, saying we need to talk to countries, we need to negotiate with countries, we shouldn't be afraid of engaging in dialogue and trying to solve problems that way instead of relying, you know, primarily on the military. And so he took a lot of heat for that, including from Hillary Clinton, saying, oh, you don't understand how politics works, and the president should never lower himself to speaking with heads of these, you know, terrible countries and so forth. You know, and he basically said, well, if these are the people you have an issue with, that's who you need to talk to. I mean, you know, it's pretty simple at one level. And I hope that that is, that spirit will continue in his administration, that he won't be sort of convinced by the Washington insiders to pull back from that.
And isn't it interesting now that it's Hillary Clinton who has to go out and make friends with the Iranians and talk to them and be, you know, the ultimate diplomat. Isn't that ironic?
Well, I think the good news is she wants to be good at her job.
She does.
Whatever her job happens to be.
Yes.
And she wants to make some sort of mark in history. And if she's not going to be president, then, you know, I think being associated with some major breakthrough in producing nuclear weapons is her best route to really being remembered as somebody who is just sort of a run-of-the-mill politician.
Yeah, I think it's very fascinating what's happening. Well, Bill Hartung, we've run out of time, and it's been most fascinating, I think, that this is one of the major issues that the American people need to understand at great depth, because by understanding this, they can then move and impact their society in a very positive way. And the work that you do is imperative for all of us who want to understand more about this. And
well, I think it's, you know, the time is now. I think we can do it if we really put our minds and our souls to it.
I absolutely agree. Well, thank you very much, Bill, for coming on the show today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
My guest on If You Love This Planet today was Director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New American Foundation, Bill Hartung. And thanks for listening today. I hope you take what was discussed extremely seriously. Now, as Bill said, is the time to act. And, you know, I think it's all very hopeful and optimistic. So with that wrap up, we will talk to you again next week.
For more information about the New America Foundation and what was discussed on the program today, go to newamerica.net. That's newamerica.net.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.